But let me begin by telling you a little bit about George Marshall. I have written numerous books, but let me tell you, this is my favorite book, and it's the book that I think most deserves to be read because we need more leaders like George Marshall today. A few years ago, Tom Brokaw wrote a wonderful book called The Greatest Generation, and he called George Marshall the godfather of the greatest generation. But he also said something profound. He said, George Marshall is also the unknown famous American. Many people know the name, they know the Marshall Plan, but they don't know the breadth and scope of this man's remarkable career. And as Brian said, Truman said, succeeding generations shouldn't be allowed, mustn't forget his lessons. And yet, sadly, unfortunately, many Americans don't have the slightest idea of who George Marshall is. And this is a tragedy, and it's one that has to be rectified because we still have so much to learn from him today. Let me just tell you a few of the other things that famous people said about George Marshall. FDR, arguably one of the greatest presidents of the United States, essentially had the opportunity. I want people to know this. Just yesterday I was down in Roanoke and I was driving by the museum of the National D-Day Museum. Few Americans know this. By every right, by knowledge, seniority, experience, and skill, it should have been George Marshall who was leading our troops into its greatest battle, in its greatest war. And yet that didn't happen. Why didn't it happen? It's because only George Marshall understood the war in the Pacific. Only George Marshall understood what was happening in Europe. Only George Marshall could deal with the personalities of Douglas MacArthur and Patton. Only he could deal with the personalities of Churchill and de Gaulle. He was too important to put in one theater, no matter how important that theater was. And at the end of the day, the decision, he simply said, I can't sleep with you out of the country, General Marshall, and thus did escape one of the greatest invitations to all-time glory. But George Marshall never said a word about it because it was never about George Marshall. It was always about something bigger. The man who did lead D-Day said this, never has our army or our people been so indebted to one soldier. And why did he say that? He said that because he knew that it was George Marshall who on D-Day had trained, the troops had been trained according to the rules Marshall developed. They were in units that were designed by Marshall, and the troops were ultimately led by the generals that George C. Marshall selected. That's why we were so indebted to George C. Marshall. But it doesn't stop there. Harry Truman said he is the greatest military officer this country has ever produced. He said, the more I see of him, the more I'm convinced he is the great one of the age. Your table earlier said that resolve and Winston Churchill, voted by historians the greatest leader of the 20th century, he said of George Marshall, he said, it wasn't your lot to command the great armies. All you had to do was create them, organize them, and inspire them. The end of the war, he said, George C. Marshall was the true organizer of victory. But of all the quotes that famous and great individuals have said of George Marshall, I think the one that he most would have enjoyed is one that Winston Churchill said to his physician. Upon seeing Marshall, he said, there goes the noblest Roman. And what he was referring to, those of you who are VMI grads or others, you might know the legend of Cincinnatus, the citizen from Rome who was plucked off his farm and became dictator of Rome and led the country to victory, and after he had done that, surrendered power and went back to his farm. That is the model that George Marshall not only aspired to, but he lived throughout his entire career. Now, I was talking with Charlie earlier, and he said he has bought, to understand the breadth and scope of George C. Marshall's life, it helps to understand that his official biography is 4 volumes and 1,900 pages long. So for your benefit, I am going to condense this remarkable career down to 3 minutes and just give you a scope of his life. Few people know that he was the second soldier off the boat in the First World War. He then went on to organize and plan the largest offensive maneuver in the First World War. Two of them. In fact, in one, over the course of an evening, he had to shift 400,000 troops and bring them to another front, and he did it. For that, he earned the name the Wizard. And General Pershing, hero of the First World War, said, "He is the finest officer that the First World War produced." So arguably, he had a huge impact on the First World War. But it doesn't stop there. During the 1920s, he is training 200 future generals of the next war. In the 1930s, he is working with the Civilian Conservation Corps and National Guard troops. Why? Because he knows that there's another war on the horizon, but the regular army can't do it. We are going to have to require and need the services and skills of the citizens. And George Marshall is working with them throughout the 30s. During the 1940s, he becomes chief of staff. And let me just say two things about this, because I'm going to focus my remarks mostly on his career at this stage, is that in 1942, the war for America and the Allies is not going well. Germany is still advancing into the Soviet Union. Japan is still sweeping down across the Pacific. And there are great men struggling with this, but in 1942, Time magazine looks at all of these great individuals, including Churchill and FDR, and says that the Time Man of the Year is George C. Marshall. He is the indispensable man. And at the end of his term in 1945, Harry Truman said this. He said, "In a war of unparalleled magnitude and horror, millions of Americans gave their country great service. General of the Army George C. Marshall gave it victory." But his career doesn't end there. He has arguably the shortest retirement in history. One day later, President Truman calls him back to serve essentially as ambassador to China. But it doesn't end there. In 1947, he becomes Secretary of State. And to understand the condition of the world in 1947, America as a nation is exhausted from war. Germany is crushed. Great Britain is bankrupt. France and Italy are tinkering and toying with communism. Korea is divided. India is seeking independence, and Israel wants statehood. And George Marshall is Secretary of State during this incredible period. And what does he do? He only achieves what historians have called the greatest diplomatic act of the 20th century. He called into being the Marshall Plan that helped rebuild Europe and arguably kept the peace in Europe and the broader world for the next 70 years, and we're still prospering under his visionary leadership. As remarkable as that is, it doesn't stop there. He then serves as Secretary of Defense. And during this period, all he has to do is the Korean War is now heating up. He oversees the fastest, largest mobilization in American military history, faster than World War II. He creates the Air Force. He creates the Central Intelligence Agency. He creates the National Security Council, all in less than a year. It's a remarkable career. But let me just say, why do we need to study the leadership lessons of George C. Marshall? Let me give you one story. And I'm going to just relate it to his leadership during the war. He becomes chief of staff of the Army on September 1st, 1939, At 3 a.m., the morning he is to be sworn in, he receives a telephone call, and the person says, Germany has just invaded Poland. World War II has begun. The very day he has to take over head of the army. And what does he take over? He takes over an army that is only 175,000 troops strong. It's only the 17th largest army in the world. Our troops are still training with 1903 Springfield bolt-action rifles. And yet, in the course of the next 6 years, he creates and oversees the creation of an army of 8.3 million people. It has a global supply chain that literally stretches 60,000 miles around the globe. There is an air force of 129,000 bombers and 2.5 million jeeps. He does all of this in 5 years. I am telling you, all of us, all of our organizations and society are going to go through a period of comparable change in the near future, and this is the work I do as a futurist. But I'm absolutely convinced we can continue to thrive and survive all of this change if we adhere to the leadership principles of George C. Marshall. So how did he do it? In a word, leadership. And let me just focus on the 9 leadership principles that allowed Marshall to do this. I'm going to begin with the leadership principle of candor. Picture this. The year is 1938, and he has been appointed deputy chief of staff. And he is an ambitious soldier. He wants to become chief of staff of the Army, and he has his first meeting with President Roosevelt, and he's invited into the White House. And the gist of the meeting is Roosevelt has looked over to Europe, and he sees Hitler building up. And in order to counter this, he says to his 10 other cabinet members, he said, I suggest we build 10,000 airplanes, that will show Hitler we're serious, and it will cause him to step back. And he then queries every one of his cabinet members, and every one of them says, yes, Mr. President, that's a great idea. That's exactly what needs to be done. If that's what you need done, that's what we will do. He finally gets to General Marshall, and he says, what do you think, George? And he never again called him George. He only called him General after this. And he goes, no, Mr. President, I disagree with you. And here's why. That we can't just build 10,000 planes. We have to staff them with trained pilots. We need mechanics to work on them. We need to do a lot more. That is an idle threat. Roosevelt steps back, adjourns the meeting. They leave. The other cabinet secretaries turn to him and say, it was nice knowing you in Washington, General Marshall. You're done. But what did FDR see in George C. Marshall? He saw in him someone who was going to tell him not what he wanted to hear, but what he needed to hear. And many of us in this country know that we face serious issues. And we need more leaders telling us not what we want to hear, but what we need to hear. And Marshall serves as a wonderful example. The second leadership principle is integrity. The year is now 1941. And for the past year, 1 million American troops have been drafted into service. And their time is now approaching. Their year in service is almost up. America at this time is fiercely isolationist. They've lived through the First World War. They see the war in Europe, and they, for the most part, do not want to participate again. But George Marshall sees the fire brewing over in Europe and says, we have to keep these soldiers in service. And a historian said, and Congress had the vote. It was Congress's responsibility to keep them in. And the historian said, I have never in the history of Capitol Hill seen such fear of a bill. They didn't want to vote on this issue. They knew what needed to be done, but they didn't want to take the political heat. So they said, well, let's just sneak in an amendment and pass the responsibility off to the president. General Marshall, would you go along with this? He says, no, I won't. I want to go straight down the road. I'm going to tell people what needs to be done, and no one is going to shirk their responsibility. He then had to lobby for months. But appreciate this. By a single vote, by a vote of 203 to 201, Congress did finally accept their responsibility. We kept those troops in uniform, and 3 months later, when we were attacked at Pearl Harbor, a grateful nation owed General Marshall a debt of gratitude because he convinced Congress to do the right thing, and we need more leaders like that. The third leadership principle, George Marshall always said, man is made for action. Get action where action is needed. And he backed this up with his own actions. There's a wonderful story in 1941. A young major by the name of Walter Bedell Smith, who later became the head of the Central Intelligence Agency, bursts into Marshall's office. Marshall is meeting with a handful of other four-star generals, and Smith sort of backs out and says, excuse me. And Marshall says, no, if you have something so urgent, come in, tell me what it is you have to say. And Smith comes in and he says, well, I've just been introduced to this new technology. I think it really has the impact to change the face of the war. He describes the Jeep. On the spot, after a three-minute briefing, Marshall approves 70 Jeeps. After those Jeeps have been created, they go on to build 1,500 more, but by year's end, or by war's end, there were over 2 million Jeeps in service. And German military commanders, after the war, said that it was this device that helped give the maneuverability to the Allied troops in Europe that helped hasten the end of the war. But I would submit to you that it was Marshall's willingness to get action where action was needed that helped finish the war a lot sooner. The fourth leadership principle is selflessness. And I would argue this should actually be the first leadership principle. And let me tell you the story. Earlier I alluded to why it was that George Marshall didn't become the commander of Operation Overlord, what we now know as D-Day. And there was a wonderful story a few months before Roosevelt has to make this decision. And he is meeting with Dwight Eisenhower. And he goes, Ike, you and I know who the chief of staff in the Civil War was, but nobody else knows the chief of staff. Yet every school child knows the great generals, the Grants, the Lees, the Jacksons. I hate to think 50 years from now, nobody will know George Marshall. He deserves his rightful place in history. So he knew that Marshall deserved this and wanted it. But he also was a canny politician, and he said, I don't want to make this decision. What I'm going to do is I'm going to make Marshall ask for it. But he knew Marshall even better maybe than Marshall knew himself, because he knew that it was never about Marshall. Marshall was not going to ask anything of himself, and he simply said, I will serve wherever you need me, Mr. President. And that gave FDR the invitation to select Dwight Eisenhower, and as I said earlier, there went the greatest invitation to battlefield glory in history. History now knows that Dwight D. Eisenhower rode that all the way to the presidency, but it speaks to George Marshall's selflessness. It was never about George Marshall, it was always about something more. The fifth leadership principle is preparation. Earlier I said, and this is an underappreciated aspect of George Marshall's leadership, during the 1920s, he oversaw and rewrote the Army curriculum. He said, he looked at the First World War and he said, what is coming next is unparalleled. We have to begin training our troops for a war that is going to be uncertain, rapid, haste. It's going to be a fog of confusion. And he was constantly training soldiers to do just that. And by that visionary leadership, we had the right leadership in place when this new war came. I want you to appreciate how much change George Marshall oversaw. From the time he became Chief of Staff of the Army, the Air Force literally grew 350-fold. He understood how wireless technology, the tank, the aircraft, was going to transform warfare well beyond his peers, but he was always training them for this future that was coming. And he did this by saying, we have to always study the first 6 months of the next war. We can't look back, we have to look forward. And I can't tell you, in our world of rapid change, where there are advances in nanotechnology, biotechnology, genomics, robotics, all of these things are coming. We as a society have to start studying the first 6 months of the next war. And if we do that, and if we follow George Marshall's leadership principle, we will be prepared for this future. The seventh leadership principle is vision. George Marshall always asked, what needs to be done? What is the highest priority? And historians have said there are two really big strategic decisions that had to be made in the Second World War, and George Marshall was the one promoting both of them. Here's the first one, is that we were attacked at Pearl Harbor. An American sentiment and an American emotion said we have to go after the Japanese first. George Marshall looked at the big picture and said, I understand that, but what you have to understand is if Germany is allowed to defeat the Soviet Union and grab that massive lot of land and use those natural resources, she will have a pool of natural resources from which to prosecute a war from which we might not be able to recover. We have to go after Germany first. This was a controversial decision, and it took George Marshall 2 years to convince both individuals within the United States as well as the Allied powers that this was the way to do it. Great Britain, remember, they had lost an entire generation in the First World War, and they did not want another war in Europe. But George Marshall said, if we want to end this war, we have to have boots on the ground, and we have to go straight to Berlin. And as I said, it took him a while, but ultimately he was victorious, and that strategy proved to be right. The second great strategic decision was unity of command. Understand this, in the history of warfare, never had Allied partners agreed to share power. That is a foreign concept. It is not a natural one for military leaders, and yet George Marshall knew that it was absolutely critical. We needed the United States, Great Britain, Canada, Australia, all working together on the same page. German high command, and Hitler specifically, always thought that unity of command would break down and that it would prove a weakness for the Allied powers, but it wasn't. And behind the scenes, holding it all together, was General George C. Marshall. But let me just speak to one story that addresses his remarkable vision, and it's this. The year's 1942, and as I said earlier, the war is going awfully. But in the midst of all of this, George Marshall looks to the future and he says, you know what, at some point we are going to defeat the Japanese and we are going to defeat Germany. And when we do that, we will need military officers to govern in a civilian capacity. So he was preparing for victory and post-war occupation 3 years before we had to do it. And I would submit to you, when you look back at 2004 and Iraq, our military performed wonderfully. What we failed to do after is to think about post-war occupation. Again, the point is George C. Marshall still offers leadership lessons that leaders today can apply. At the end of the day, George Marshall, one of my favorite quotes is this, "Wars are won by the side that accomplishes the impossible." So how is it that you accomplish the impossible? I can't get into the mind of George C. Marshall, but I think that there are two principles that allowed him to do this. The first is we had to choose the right leaders. Great leaders train other leaders. And again, I look around this room, I look at Justin, and I met Andy and some others, John, some young leaders here. I think that your club is doing a great job of developing future leaders. What people don't appreciate about George Marshall is that it was George Marshall who, at the beginning of the war, literally had to sack 500 generals. He said, they are fighting the wrong war. They don't have the skills and the stamina that it takes. And he pulled from the ranks of lieutenant colonels the names of Eisenhower, Bradley, Patton, Ridgway, all heroes, but it was George Marshall's visionary leadership that pulled those equally visionary leaders and put them in leadership positions. Great leaders train other leaders. But at the end of the day, as wonderful as leaders are, they're not the ones who get the job done. George Marshall cared about his troops. He always said, we're going to take care of the troops first, last, and always. And let me just bookend George Marshall's career. As a young second lieutenant, he worked in what's western Texas and Oklahoma, and at one point he's charting that area, but they run out of water. It's 120 degrees. So for 50 miles, George Marshall goes without water so that his troops can have water. He lost 35 pounds. By the time he finally pulled in to a fort, they didn't even recognize him, and they said, you can't be an officer. But he was always taking care of his troops. But here's the other end of his career. So after he has served as Chief of Staff of the Army, Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense, he has had only 19 days of vacation between 1939 and 1948. And yet, when they ask him to become President of the American Red Cross, he says, I will do it. Why? Because he knew hundreds of thousands of his troops had been wounded and needed caring, and he was going to take care of his troops first, last, and always. Why? Because the only way you're going to do the impossible is to inspire the actions and the leaderships of the troops. And George Marshall did all of that. And earlier I said he was, Winston Churchill called him the noblest Roman. I would call him the noblest American. And here's why. That the Time magazine, when they named him Man of the Year, said American democracy is the stuff Marshall is made of. He is civis Americanus. And what many people don't appreciate is that George Marshall is the only professional soldier to ever be awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. And why is that? It is because he said the best way to win the next war is to prevent it from ever happening in the first place. And for all of these reasons, we owe General George C. Marshall a debt of gratitude, and we cannot forget the legacy of his leadership. I sincerely appreciate you inviting me here to address your organization.